Hi, this is Aya Sharif and welcome to the Sustainability Talk brought to you by Dialectic Institution. Today, we will speak about human rights with Ms. Imtithal Audi, who is a human rights officer at the UN Office of the High Commissioner in Geneva. She has national and international experience in research, nonprofit, and policy making. As a refugee herself, she focused her studies, research, and advocacy towards the enhancement of the conditions of marginalized groups. Hello, Imtithal, and it is great having you in the third episode of the Sustainability Talk.
Hello, Aya. Thank you so much for having me today. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Actually, it is the first episode of 2023 as well. Imtithal, I'm going to start with question number one. In 1948, world leaders convened at the UN General Assembly and agreed on a roadmap to guarantee the rights of every individual everywhere. The fruit of the Universal Convention was the development of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Based on your experience, Imtithal, could you please walk us through the fundamentals of this Universal Declaration and the true value behind it?
Thank you, Aya, for this very important and insightful question. Because when we want to speak about human rights, we can't really but start with the comprehensive overview of what human rights means and what does it entail. So human rights are universal and inalienable. It's indivisible, interdependent, and interrelated. And this was in the preamble of the Human Rights Declaration. So what do we mean when we say it's universal? So it's universal because everyone is born with and possesses the same rights, regardless of where they live, their gender or race, or their religious, cultural, or ethnic background. So as mentioned earlier, so I'm a refugee myself, but that doesn't mean that I don't hold the same rights as an American citizen holds or as a Lebanese citizen holds. So I hold the same rights as any other individual. So it is a universal rights that everyone holds.
Rights for everyone, everywhere, at any time as
exactly.
well.
Exactly, exactly. And second, it's inalienable because people's rights can never be taken away. So no one should take away my rights. And actually, it's because of this that I had this kind of awareness. Because when I was studying economics, I had no clue what to do next. And I didn't find anything, even as an internship. But then when I realized that I need to understand why I'm not capable of finding anything because of my status, it's a right that no one should take it from me. It is then when I started digging deep into human rights and becoming passionate about it. And it is, as I said earlier, it's indivisible and interdependent, and it's because all rights, political, civil, social, cultural, and economic rights, are equal in importance, and none can be fully enjoyed without the others. So, for example, I can't, if there is actually like a poor political system, there is corruption at a political level, this will affect my other rights anyhow, because if there's corruption, they won't be a good education system, there won't be a good health system. And this, in conclusion, will affect my other rights, because the political rights are violated. If I can't vote, then I don't have my political rights, my civil rights. And this, as I said, it's all connected. One leads to the other. It's a cycle. If one right is violated, other rights will be violated as well. And they apply to all equally and all have the right to participate in decisions that affect their rights. So they are upheld by the rule of law and strengthened through legitimate claims to duty bearers. So as you said, it's adopted in 1948 and it was after the World War II. And it is adopted as a common standard of achievement for peoples and all nations, because we are all born free and equal in dignity and rights, regardless, again, of the nationality, place of residence, gender, national or ethnic origin. So it is in a very summarized way, human rights are for everyone, everywhere, at any time and any cost, under any circumstances. And it doesn't mean that if my status as a refugee or as a migrant or as a woman, it will hinder my capability of actually achieving my human rights. It's a human rights for everyone.
Thank you very much, Imtithal. It brings me back to the sentence that was very famous amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The world is not safe if not everyone is safe. And then human rights are not safe if not everyone is enjoying them, actually. Thank you so much, Imtithal. Now we're going to delve into question number two relating to the human rights-based approach that's taking the talk in the halls of powers and the talks of leaders. Could you please introduce us to this approach and what are the five main principles of this rights-based framework?
Of course. So human rights-based approach is about turning human rights from purely legal instruments into effective policies and practices. And for example, that we have the Convention on the Rights of the Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. So the states that ratified this convention should adopt it into its laws and amend its laws to be in coherence with the convention that it signed. And that's why, for example, we have UPR, like the Universal Periodic Review. We have monitoring, which I will delve deep just in a second when I talk more about the principles. But also, human rights principles and standards, they provide guidance about what should be done to achieve the human rights and to achieve freedom and to achieve dignity, and at the same time, how they can achieve it. So how can we achieve it? We can't really say that we have the convention, like this numerous conventions, and we have the Human Rights Declaration, but we still kind of face a lot of violations. We still face a lot of challenges, but we can't say it's useless. So we can't really blame the system. It's more of that how we implemented, how we raised the awareness among each other about our rights and how to implement our rights and the correct ways to implement them, because we all have to work together so we leave no one behind. So you asked about the principles. So first, I'd say it's the participation. And for me, it's meaningful participation because everyone has the right to participate in decisions which affect their human rights. And as I can observe now, more and more civil society organizations and even the UN, they're more about the meaningful participation, which is to have the people who are affected by an issue to help them participate in solving it and being part of the solution rather than just a beneficiaries that they have. Like, I don't know how to say it and to put it in words, but for example, me as a refugee, when I want to see a solution, I don't want the solution to come from a Western perspective that doesn't understand my culture and my challenges and my potential opportunities.
So you mean your participation in the development process?
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. And so, have your voice offering scalable solutions that are relevant to your national context.
Exactly, exactly. Because when anyone is speaking about my rights, I should be at the table discussing these rights, you know, because like you can't really offer a solution for a young person. If you're an 80-year-old man, you have a lot of experiences, but then you don't really know exactly the struggles of the young people now.
So based on the context in terms of geography, demography, and like the behavioral common insights.
True, exactly, exactly. Because no one really knows the challenges and the potential opportunities more than the people affected by it. So again, as a refugee, I would definitely like to be put into the table with other policymakers and discuss what might be possible solutions to achieve my rights. So how can we achieve these rights and what should be done to achieve these rights? For me, the meaningful and active participation is of essence. Second, we have accountability, and accountability requires effective monitoring of compliance with the human rights standards and the achievement of the human rights. And that's why we have the Universal Periodic Review, we have the policies, we have mechanisms, there's the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights.
These periodic reviews are conducted by the UN system or by UN system in collaboration with the governments?
So it is by the UN system, and then the states, it's within the cycle. And every state, I think every 3 or 4 years, they have to submit their report. And this report should be how did they work on their human rights situations in their states and how they adopted the conventions that they have ratified into their laws, and how if they're violating any, and if they're not, then how have they developed their laws and what are the progress.
So Imtithal, looking at the current status quo and after these crazy 3 years of like unprecedented events, you think we're moving backward or forward in terms of human rights policy making and formulation?
That's a very nice question. Thank you. From a personal perspective, I believe we're moving forward because we kind of, everyone realized
awareness.
The world awareness
exactly, is the key. Yeah.
Exactly. There was like this awareness that was very much needed about leave no one behind. Like it was a hit. So it has hindered a lot of developments towards, let's say, the 2030 agenda. It has put us a bit of backwards on what can be achieved and at a human rights and development level. But there was an awareness about their rights, what shall be done, how can they consume more of their energy towards a beneficial and effective measures. So I think for human rights, yes, in my own perspective, it has put in it a bit forward. So I was optimistic after the COVID.
Okay, and we can see this mobilization that has been taking place, especially on social media. We see our youth advocating for their rights. We see our youth having an in-depth understanding of the UN 2030 agenda and what does it mean to have a sustainable world. And we really do have a smart generation coming up that are voicing their concerns, their ideas. And whenever they're not having a place on the table, they are bringing their folding table and sitting, whether you want to hear us or no, we are here to speak our ideas. And this is something that's really promising for the future.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Because I think also we can give credit a bit for social media, maybe.
Yeah.
It has its pros and cons, but at the
depends
at the
on
end,
how you utilize it. Yeah,
exactly. Like whenever anything is happening, everyone would just have to share a post, and then thousands would be reposting it. So social media has really raised awareness and has really kind of
amplified.
Yeah, it amplified our rights, our understanding of what is our rights.
So Amtithal, now we're going to be drilling deeper from the second principle, which is accountability, to the third principle, which is?
It is non-discrimination and equality. So a human rights-based approach means that all forms of discrimination in the realization of rights must be prohibited, prevented, and eliminated. So it should be given priority to the most marginalized and vulnerable situations who face the biggest barriers in realizing their rights, and that's basically leave no one behind. So we should also we should really give attention to the marginalized populations, to those in the least developed countries. We should give a lot of priority to women, especially in our region, I think, in my perspective. So it is based on the non-discrimination and equality, which is related to that everyone has the same rights and we should realize it.
Actually, Amtithal, if you look at the Arab MENA region and specifically in Lebanon and in the GCC countries such as Qatar, Dubai, Saudi Arabia, I have been working closely with partners from the private sector. And we see that diversity, equity, and inclusion HR strategies are on the rise. And it's very promising to see the private sector also taking the lead and taking its steps further and faster in this sphere.
Exactly, I agree. And I'm very, very actually happy to see even in job descriptions, they say if you're a female, you have even a higher chance to get hired. So they're even more into equality and non-discrimination. And it's nice to have this human rights-based approach, actually, even in the private sector. And it's very promising, I agree.
Yeah, and now when we talk about recruitment efforts, we see that there is a new wording or a jargon in the HR world, which is gender-inclusive recruitment. So whenever you're posting a job opening on LinkedIn or any recruitment website, there are some guidelines and frameworks that you need to adhere to make sure that the recruitment post is gender-inclusive. For instance, we don't say chairman, chairperson. We don't say like office man, you know what? Or yes, a salesman, salesperson. So in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion, I think in terms of implementation and in terms of the engagement of the private sector, the UN system, and the academic sector, in terms of educating young girls and females, we're moving forward.
Of course, of course. Yes, we're definitely moving forward. And that's really good because, again, maybe we can link it to a wider perspective of awareness, like there's been a lot of raising awareness about how to respect each other's rights and each other's differences. And our region is really seeing a very promising future. But again, as long as they're respecting the rights, we will reach there. There's definitely hope. There's definitely a way to get there, and we will get there. But it's good to see that they're starting to adhere to the
and
human
the region.
Rights perspective and to include everyone.
And let us not deny the fact that we have hosted the two biggest events of the world, starting from Dubai, Expo 2020 Dubai. We've seen the UN system present in a prominent way and promoting the SDGs in a very appealing way at the Expo 2020. And looking at the World Cup in Qatar, we saw like amazing harmony in the region, and we saw a great adherence to human rights and to the sustainable development goals as well. So yeah, we're moving forward. Our region is proving and unleashing the power of its talents, its abilities, and its competitiveness.
Exactly true. I do agree. And for example, now Qatar will host the conference on the least developed countries to adopt the program of work for the next 10 years. So again, as you said, major events are also happening.
When is this conference happening?
It's in March.
Okay.
Yeah, so it will be happening in March in Qatar, and yeah, it will gather the state representatives, the civil society, academics. So it will host people from all over the world to discuss the program of work for the least developed countries for the next 10 years.
And let us, since we're talking about Qatar, let us highlight the fact that the Human Rights Committee in Qatar has been doing a great job in terms of ratifying, amending, and developing their policies in a way that's catered to a human rights-based approach. So, Anjad, the progress has been very prominent, and the work being done is very highly appreciated.
Yeah, I do agree, because especially on Qatar, I think there has been a lot of debates recently about whether they are adhering to the human rights or not. But again, from a personal perspective, I think that, yeah, they have been amending their laws to become actually better.
They removed the kafala system.
True.
And they have they enhance the bargaining power of employees. They have a decent living wage standard. Mm-hmm. So they're stepping into great milestones.
Exactly. True. They're a good, I think, example to refer to when talking about amending the laws.
So now we're going to step into principle number 4.
Yeah, and just not to take a lot of time, I will speak very much quickly about them. So the fourth one, yeah, it's about empowerment. And again, it's entitled that to claim and exercise their rights and freedoms, and to understand actually their rights. And it's also linked again to the raising awareness that if I'm a refugee, I should understand what rights do I hold. And the final one is about the legality, and it's about how the law recognizes the human rights and to be legally enforceable entitlements.
Thank you, Imtithal. And now we're going to step into question number 3 relating to the UN 2030 agenda and sustainability. So as you may know, and definitely you know, in December 2015, leaders of nations, governments, high UN representatives, business leaders and policymakers convened at the UN summit in the city of New York and launched the UN 2030 agenda of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs. It is commonly known that forging sustainability is a key to the enjoyment of all human rights. From a research and policy-making perspective, could you please highlight the interplay and the interconnectedness between sustainability and the right to development?
Thank you so much, Aya, for bringing right to development. So actually, the Declaration on the Right to Development that has been adopted in 1986, it's marked a significant evolution in the global understanding of what is development. And as it comes in the Declaration, it is a comprehensive economic, social, cultural, and political process which aims at the constant improvement of all well-being of the entire population and all individuals on the basis of their active, free, and meaningful participation in development and in their fair distribution of benefits resulting therefrom. So it is actually, it's at a global level, it's a kind of rejection of development understood purely on economic terms. Because when we say development, first thing that comes into our minds is the economic development.
No, it's cultural development.
Exactly.
It's educational development.
Yes, but you also think about, let's say, building, and there's new projects, construction.
Touristic development.
Touristic development.
There's smart cities is within
exactly.
the development agenda. So it's a broad agenda.
But I mean, for the writer development, it's not only on purely economic trends, but it also focuses on the people. So it's having the people at the center of
educated.
Development. Yes. So educated, again, from a human rights-based approach, they are meaningful and active participation. And it is, in a way, it's not a charity. So development, it shouldn't be viewed as a charity that someone would just, okay, there's a project there to enhance development and that's it. No, it is a right. It is a right. There should be duty to cooperate between like the nations and between like locally, between organizations and different stakeholders and nationally, regionally and internationally to achieve the right to development because it's perceived as a right. It's my right. The sustainable development, it was defined as development that meets the needs of the present generation without compromising the ability
of the
future generations to meet their own needs. So here, if we want to move for the relationship between the right to development and the sustainable development, it was specifically recognized for the first time in the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development, and it was then reiterated in the Vienna Declaration and Program of Action. That was adopted in the World Conference on Human Rights in 1993. And then there's the Millennium Development Goals, the Millennium Declaration, and it was adopted in the 2000s, which they all reaffirmed that making the right to development a reality for everyone, it's one of the main objectives. So finally, as noted, the 2030 Agenda reaffirms the right to development and is grounded in and informed by the Declaration of the Right to Development. So they are very much connected. So here is the right to development, however, must not be viewed or reduced to the 2030 agenda because the 2030 agenda was adopted in 2015 and it's time bound. But the right to development, it's a right. So it's something you have endlessly. It's a universal right, it's interlinked with other rights, and it's not only time bound.
So in other words, is if you want to take SDG1 relating to no poverty, achieving this goal will enhance the right to economic development. For instance, SDG4 on quality education, achieving this goal will enhance the right to education. SDG8 relating to decent work conditions and economic growth will lead to the right to participation.
Exactly.
So it's a game of interplayness.
It's interplayness. If we want to take it through the principles and elements. So for example, there is in the right to development principles and elements, we have people-centered development and we have a human rights-based approach. So and we also have a state as primary duty bearer. So these are three principles. They are the SDGs from 1 to 16. They are the the SDGs and their target. So they are very interlinked. And if we talk about the participation, equality, and non-discrimination, accountability, and transparency, which is a principle and an element for right to development, this has been mentioned in the SDG 1, 2, 4, 5, 8, 10, and 16, and so on. So the list just goes on and on. Like, for example, to promote international peace and security, this is SDG 16, but it is at the same time, it's an RTD, which is right to development principle.
Right to freedom.
Exactly. We have good governance and global partnership at a national and international dimension, and this is under a lot of the SDGs and targets. So it's very much interrelated and interconnected for sure.
Thank you very much, Imtithal. And as a firm believer in the power of storytelling, and as a Palestinian refugee, you yourself, can you please tell us about the human rights-based challenges encountered by Palestinian refugees in the Arab MENA region?
Thank you so much, Aya, for actually such an emotional question. And I think it's very much important and it will link all what we have discussed today into and how I can fit it into this story. So it would be more lively even apart from the kind of human rights in scientific terms. I've grown up to Palestinian parents who've been here, as you know, since the 1948, but yet we don't have a citizenship. And this has, of course, a lot of challenges. One of the challenges was, which every Palestinian faces, is like to own property, to the access to the education system, to access to the health system, access to a lot of rights that even if we have a slight access to it, we come as second and fourth priorities. Like I do remember my brother, even for this year, he has to wait until like late September, early October to confirm that he has a seat at the school, because they, of course, they have the preferences for all the Lebanese students at first. So we still kind of face these kinds of challenges even after all these years, even after 7 decades, which is a kind of a pity.
But in terms of the school's issue, it is the private school or a public school?
It's a public school.
Okay.
And then in terms of a personal story, so again, when I was raised up, I didn't really have been raised into with a family which is like kind of a wealthy family or like an educated family. So it's kind of I'm the first person in my family to go to university, and then I achieved this by earning like a scholarship to go and study at AUB. So I studied economics at the American University of Beirut, and at that time when I wanted to do an internship, I didn't even get an internship at a bank or a consultancy firm, because the fact that I'm a Palestinian refugee or my status as a refugee hindered my opportunities, despite being a distinction student, you know. So my grades were late 80s, early 90s, but still I didn't have a lot of opportunities. And it is then I started to question, why is this? Like, why my friends, they secured a lot of opportunities, even internship or even jobs, but I couldn't. And why is it hindering? I didn't really realize that we had all of these distinctions and discrimination against Palestinian refugees even after all these decades. And we don't really realize this because we assume ourselves as refugees. It's good that they're keeping us in their countries, you know, and كتر خيرون, that they are hosting us. But then I started questioning, and of course I was surrounded by inspiring people and supportive people. So I applied then to study human rights at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And honestly, I didn't want to apply because I didn't believe I would get in, you know. But then my friend, a dear friend, he encouraged me and he helped me through the process to apply, and I got in. But then when I got accepted, I was like, okay, what shall I do with the acceptance now? I can't really afford it. But then, you know, I really don't know how things happen, but then I got a scholarship and I went there to study human rights, like master's in human rights. And afterwards, it then COVID hit, and I didn't really get the essence or the answers of the questions that I wanted from the degree that I did. So I applied to another master's degree because it was anyways difficult to get a job during COVID. But still in my head, it is that I have to have a competitive power. So as a refugee, if I only have one master's, I think, okay, it's kind of the discrimination will still be there. But if I have two master's, then maybe this will give a good impression on
my study. You worked on boosting your credentials.
Yes, so no one should. So I won't hear
so
no again.
So this is how you transformed your challenges into real opportunities.
yes, like to work on my abilities and on my skills so that my status won't be taken as an answer to give me a no, that we can't really hire you, we can't really work for you, or to get any kind of discrimination. So I worked on my skills, on my education, and then I got into the UN. So I got into, now I'm working with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva. So it's kind of the transforming the challenges which we face in terms of discrimination. There's a lack of opportunity. It is actually to keep on applying. We should keep on pursuing our full potential. We should realize our potential first and foremost, and this is by surrounding ourselves with supportive people.
With the right people.
With the right people, exactly. So I was surrounded with my very two best friends who made me realize my potential. Like, I was in London, okay, I was maybe the youngest in my class, and it's LSE, it was a bit of competitive school, but I didn't really realize it until they convinced me to trust my abilities, and I'm here because I deserve it, and it's because of a reason. And they always push me for the best and to give the best I can have, because I already have it, but I have to realize it, I have to acknowledge it, and to trust my intuition and to trust myself. So I think it like the personal development and the growth on a personal level goes hand in hand with the professional growth as well. So yeah, that's basically kind of my story.
That's really a powerful story, and I hope this will help the 2023 resolution for many young females, whether they are Palestinian, Lebanese, because we know in the Arab MENA region, and especially in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Palestine, people are facing a lot of multifaceted crises, and I hope this gloomy cloud will go soon. Imtithal, derived from your personal experience and in one sentence, typically in one sentence, what empowering advice would you like to give for Palestinian female refugees in one sentence?
Okay, thanks for emphasizing in one sentence.
Actually, this is a sentence.
I think I would the advice that I would give, especially for Palestinian female refugees, is to break the cycle of being in liminal limbo. So that's in one sentence.
Amazing. Thank you. You want to illustrate?
Yes, please.
I will give you the permission.
Thank you. So it's basically, especially as women, we face a lot of the same cycles, even within like our families.
It's a pattern.
Exactly. It's a pattern.
You go to school. We get married, we bring kids, we start raising these kids.
Exactly. But if you also maybe think about it, even the traumas that our parents had, it's passed from generation to generation.
With the boosted version.
Exactly. So we're not solving it. We're not getting connected to ourselves to solve it or to break the cycle. And we're always afraid to break the cycle. And I believe that my advice would be to break the cycle, to kind of to surround yourself with supportive family and supportive friends, and that would help you to break this cycle. Even as women, we need the opportunities, and we should convince even if our parents, maybe sometimes because out of fear, they won't really give us the answers that we want to. Like, okay, yeah, go and travel and live alone.
And because they haven't been exposed to the world that we are living.
Exactly, exactly. So maybe we should help them understand this, that our generation is different. And we have to give the impression that we trust ourselves, and then we have to break the cycle of being in liminal limbo. We shouldn't accept our rights to be violated. We shouldn't accept to be left outside, not to to participate, not to have any meaningful participation. We should not accept that.
We should dare to say no as well.
Exactly, exactly. That's a bit of elaboration. Otherwise,
I just wanted to highlight something derived from your talk on the pattern that females in the Arab region tend to experience. I've read something like 2 weeks ago, a quote saying, heal before having children, so your children don't have to heal from having you as their parent.
Yes, exactly.
And this brings us back to sustainability, well-being, the right to well-being, the right to wellness. So thank you very much for highlighting this powerful personal story. Imtithal, again, thank you for the insights. Thank you for sharing your personal story. Thank you for the words of empowerment. And for our listeners, thank you for your passionate listening. Subscribe now to the Sustainability Talk at dialecticinstitution.com to stay in the know and ahead of the curve on key sustainability trends and topics. And yes, let us stay connected.